1986 to cede to the Long Island Park Commission all right, title, interest, and jurisdiction to all that certain townland commonly known as Jones Beach. More immediately, the friendship altered the balance of power in the overall state park fight. On December 21, 1925, 10 days after Moses agreed to cooperate with McWinney and the Hempstead Town Delegation, the Suffolk County Board of Supervisors passed a resolution asking the legislature to abolish the Long Island Park Commission. They sent it to the Nassau Board of Supervisors, expecting that body to concur in the request, as it had the year before. To the shock of the Suffolk officials, Nassau declined to do so. The two counties in which the Park Commission was operating were no longer united in opposing it. The GOP front in Albany was no longer solid either, because of the votes Doughty controlled in the Senate and Assembly. Republican ranks were already under severe pressure over parks. In New York City, Al Smith, taking command of Tammany Hall in fact, if not in title, after Charlie Murphy's death, had snatched the Democratic mayoral nomination away from Red Mike Hyland and handed it to Jimmy Walker. And Walker, at his inauguration on January 1, 1926, had announced support of the vast program of city parkland acquisitions prepared by the city's park association with Moses' help. There would be a referendum in November to authorize the necessary bonds, and women's clubs and a reformers' committee of 1,000 had already launched a mammoth public education campaign. All in all, 1926 was not the year to be opposing parks. Upstate Republican legislators might be insulated in their rotten boroughs, but it wasn't only legislators whose names would be on the ballot in 1926. Al Smith would be campaigning for re-election, and Republican strategists were determined to knock him out of the governorship. They had already persuaded the man they regarded as their strongest candidate, Ogden Livingston Mills, to leave Congress and run against him. And there was a United States Senate seat up for grabs, too, and the present occupant of the seat was James J. Wadsworth himself, the former Assembly Speaker and one of the state's most powerful Republicans. No sooner had the legislature convened, therefore, than Wadsworth summoned the legislative leaders to an Albany hotel suite and told them a compromise on the park fight was in order. The compromise could not be over the Northern State Parkway, he said. The interests of too many of their friends were involved there. But the Taylor estate was a different story. Havemeyer, the only timber pointer with real influence, didn't seem really interested. Macy did, but Macy had little influence of his own. The Taylor estate, the Republican leaders agreed, could be sacrificed. Smith, with his park plans stalled and the threat of the potentially embarrassing Taylor estate court fight hanging over him in an election year, was not averse to a compromise. In a secret meeting with Hewitt and Hutchinson, the governor agreed that he would not ask for funds to acquire right-of-way for the Northern State Parkway until Moses came up with a route acceptable to the barons, and he agreed that, even after the right-of-way had been acquired, he would not ask for funds to begin construction until the Southern State Parkway had reached the point at which it would connect with the Jones Beach Causeway, a point about 15 miles into Nassau County. In return, Hewitt and Hutchinson agreed that the Southern State Parkway could be built and that the entire $15 million proceeds of the park referendum would be segregated in 1926. Work could therefore begin immediately on Moses' upstate park program and his Long Island projects, including Jones Beach, the causeway leading to it from the Southern State Parkway, and Deer Range, soon to be August Hecture State Park. Since the 1925 Taylor estate fight had revolved around the question of whether an outside agency, the Republican-controlled State Land Board, should have authority over the State Parks Council, a face-saving device had to be worked out on that point, so that it would appear that neither side had surrendered. On January 26, 1926, Smith and the GOP legislative leaders announced that they had agreed that expenditures of the $15 million would be supervised, as the GOP had insisted, but, as Smith had insisted, not by the land board. Instead, it was announced, expenditures would be supervised by a committee of three, Smith, Hewitt, and Hutchinson. Macy got his first hint of what was happening when he learned that the segregations of the $15 million included an item of $25,000 for Deer Range Park, permanent improvement of buildings, and $170,000 to begin the purchase of right-of-way for the Southern State Parkway, that strip of concrete Macy had always been afraid would reach out toward East Islip. Rushing to Albany, he confronted Hutchinson, and the assemblyman answered his questions evasively. The amateur in politics realized that the professionals had betrayed him. Hewitt and Hutchinson had been pleased with the compromise with Smith. By postponing work on the Northern State Parkway until 15 miles of the Southern State were built, they thought they were consigning the former road to some far-distant limbo. Construction of the 15-mile-long Bronx River Parkway, after all, had taken 14 years. And since they could outvote Smith 2-1 on the committee set up to supervise park expenditures, they assumed they could keep the pace of construction on the Southern State slow. Economy, moreover, was as important to them as delay. Their upstate conservatism had been affronted by the thought of spending even $1 million on parks and parkways in a single section of the state. They could see that the actual amount involved would eventually be far higher than the million, but they wanted to keep it down to the bare minimum that they felt was all the state could afford. But no sooner had they given Moses $170,000 for Southern State right-of-way, confident that the amount would allow him to purchase no more than a mile or two, then the Nassau County Board of Supervisors, now suddenly and mysteriously enthusiastic over Moses' projects, purchased additional miles and presented them to the Long Island Park Commission as a gift. Playing on the greed of real estate developers who owned land in the parkway's path, Moses persuaded them to donate right-of-way, so that the rest of their property could be opened to development. Suddenly awakened to the fact that the New York City watershed property could be used as right-of-way, Hewitt and Hutchinson realized with a shock that the land for the Southern State was almost all in Moses' hands, all the way out to that magic point where it would trigger the start of work on the Northern State. Although no funds had been appropriated for surveying and engineering, there were suddenly surveyors and engineers out on the right-of-way, men furnished by the State Department of Public Works, whose Long Island office just happened to be located at the former August Belmont estate near Babylon that Moses had acquired and turned into a state park, making the old Belmont mansion his headquarters. And these men, they were told, were drawing up plans with unprecedented speed. Even as they digested this news, a bill was introduced in the legislature providing for $1 million for the construction, reconstruction, and widening of highway routes in Nassau and Erie counties, including $350,000 for construction of the Southern State Parkway. They had no trouble understanding why Erie, a Republican stronghold, had been given even more money than Nassau in the bill. Erie's legislators would be even more determined than Nassau's that the bill should pass, and an alliance of the GOP legislators from these two counties with the Democrats would make it impossible for Hewitt and Hutchinson to prevent its passage. The parks on Long Island were also being developed at a rate they could hardly believe, since they had kept appropriations for such development small. When they checked, they found that park roads were being constructed by DPW crews and park buildings refurbished by Conservation Department crews. They took a look at the bills Truby Davison had introduced for Moses in 1924 and found in them a specific provision stating that while the Long Island Park Commission would have final say on the design of parkways, as well as full control of them when completed, their physical construction could be financed out of DPW allocations. They found that the landscaping was being financed out of routine 1926 Conservation Department requests for tree nurseries. The Lloyd Neck Lighthouse property was being developed with a Conservation Department appropriation for oyster culture When they waxed indignant, they were told blandly that the lighthouse property could certainly be used for oyster culture. There was nothing the slightest bit illegal about anything Moses was doing. The best bill drafter in Albany, they realized, had been at work again. And when they protested to the governor, he bourbon-coated the bill he was making them swallow. Inviting them to see for themselves what Moses was doing, he suggested they come to New York City first, sleep over at the Biltmore, and then go on to Long Island in the morning. At the Biltmore, as Moses would later recall, the governor got Hewitt and Hutchinson to stay overnight in his apartment. They were drinking bozos, you know, and they were really putting it away. As the evening wore on, the governor put some records on, and he was teaching these two fellows to dance. I left at 2 a.m. Henry Lutz, a Moses aide, stayed until 5, and he told me it was about then that the governor and he and Hewitt put Hutchinson to bed. Hewitt got up at 7 the next morning and ordered a big breakfast for himself and the governor, and they went in to ask Hutchinson what he wanted, and Hutchinson sort of groaned, lying there in bed, and said, "Governor, go away. The stomach revolts at the thought of food." During the tour, Smith was at his friendliest. "You see," Moses would say, "in so many cases, things come down to personalities, to the human factor. And they loved the governor." And even if they hadn't, what, after all, could they do? The Highway and Conservation Department budgets had already been approved. Money was being spent under them. If they tried to reopen the budgets, it would be a mess. And what would the press say? After all, there was an election coming. They decided not to interfere with the program. The court fight still loomed ahead of Moses, but Smith was able to help him with that, too. During 1926, Moses continued his technique of stalling the trial while talking as though there were not the slightest doubt about its outcome. In an article he wrote in May, outlining the overall progress of the state park plan, he said blandly, "The state has acquired Deer Park Range." All through May, Moses' attorneys continued filing motions and, when judges overruled the motions, appealing their decisions to higher courts, and when the higher courts threw out the appeals, taking them to still higher courts. 3 separate dates were set for trial, and on each of them, appeals were still pending, and judges had to grant the commission postponements. All through May, Moses' laborers were converting the ballroom of the old Taylor Mansion into a cafeteria, the sitting room into a comfort station, setting up tents on the beach to serve as bathhouses, and hacking rough roads through the woods so that motorists could reach them. By mid-May, Deer Range State Park was open to the public. On May 25th, State Supreme Court Justice Selah B. Strong received word from Albany that the state's highest court, the Court of Appeals, had thrown out the last of Moses' appeals in a decision which supported every one of Macy's contentions, even to the point of saying that if the commission's right to peremptory appropriation was upheld, the conclusion logically follows that it has a charter wide as the wind withal, and might seize for park purposes all the lands in Nassau and Suffolk counties. Scheduling the trial for June 4th, Justice Strong told Walter H. Pollock, who was heading the team of 5 attorneys handling the case for the commission, that he would not postpone it again for any reason. On June 4th, Pollock was not in court. One of his 4 colleagues told Strong, falsely, that Pollock was occupied in another courtroom. Strong said the trial was going on anyway. "We will not participate," Pollock's colleague said, and all 4 commission attorneys walked out of the courtroom, leaving the commission without counsel. Strong adjourned the trial for a day to give Pollock a chance to appear. On the next day, Pollock and his colleagues were again absent. Strong adjourned it again, and again no attorneys appeared. On the 4th day, the judge allowed a jury to be chosen and told Macy's attorney, Charles H. Tuttle, to present his case. The jury found that both appropriations of the Taylor estate had been illegal, the first because the commission did not possess $250,000, the second because while it had the money came from a private gift instead of from a legislative segregation, the only legal source of funds for a peremptory appropriation. The judge assessed each of the three commissioners, Robert Moses, Townsend Scudder, and Clifford Jackson, $22,000 apiece in punitive damages. Strong perpetually enjoined the commission from entering the Taylor estate and ordered the state troopers removed forthwith. Watching the judge sign the injunction and hand it to the Suffolk County Sheriff, watching the sheriff leave the courtroom to serve the injunction on the state troopers, Macy thought he had won at last. Declared Tuttle, "The vindication is now complete." Bella and Emmanuel Moses were at their summer lodge at Camp Madison. Every morning, a Madison House social worker delivered a New York Times to their door. When he handed it to them on the morning after the verdict, and they leafed through it, all the trial stories were on the inside pages now, and learned of the $22,000 judgment against their son, they groaned, and Bella Moses said, "Oh, he never earned a dollar in his life, and now we'll have to pay this." The social worker recalls, "It was just assumed that they would pay it. They always paid all his debts." The day after the verdict, Pollock, suddenly free of other court engagements, appealed on the grounds that the Long Island State Park Commission had not been represented by counsel. A Brooklyn Supreme Court justice denied the appeal, calling the lack of representation a deliberate and intentional attempt to delay the proceedings. But the appellate division agreed to hear the appeal at its fall term and invalidated Strong's injunction until then. The troopers returned to the property, and during the summer, Moses took reporters on trips to Deer Range Park, and the reporters rhapsodized about the families enjoying its facilities. In the fall, the appellate division upheld Pollock's appeal and ordered a new trial. And this trial, which was to be the closest thing to a legal showdown that was to occur in the case, was to contain a new factor, Al Smith's appearance as a witness for Moses. Smith's appearance marked the first time in a generation, probably longer, that a chief executive of the state has appeared in court in the role of a witness. Platoons of reporters followed the governor as he, Moses, and Mrs. Moskowitz boarded a Long Island Railroad train for the 3-hour trip to Riverhead. At the station, he was met by an American Legion band, which played "The Sidewalks of New York" as it accompanied him to the courthouse. There, he was escorted to the chambers of Justice James A. Dunn. The governor talked with Dunn in private, and then the judge escorted him into the courtroom so that he could give his testimony. He was on the stand for only 15 minutes, spent most of the time recounting the Biltmore hearing, and was not cross-examined. And as soon as he stepped off the stand, the judge adjourned court. The governor joined him in his chambers for lunch. In the newspapers, Smith's appearance dwarfed the legal issues involved in the trial. Whether it had the same effect in the mind of Justice Dunn is unknown, which is unfortunate because the judge, not the jury, decided the case, and his directions to the jury, which precluded it from making a decision on the essential point at issue, were rather sharply at variance with those of the many other judges who had been involved with the case. Dunn directed the jury to find that the first appropriation of the Taylor estate had been illegal, but that the second had been legal, and the property therefore now belonged to the Long Island Park Commission. The only function of the jury, he told it, was to decide whether Patchogue had suffered substantial financial damages as a result of the first seizure. If it had not, he said, the jury should fix the damages against the commission at 6 cents. The jury did so. Macy was to believe until he died that Smith's entrance in the case had played a role in the judge's removal from the jury's hands of the right to make a decision on the key point in the case, the legality of the second appropriation. "The governor came down and took the judge out to lunch. What chance did we have?" he was to say. Whether Dunn's decision would have remained the binding legal word in the case if both sides had continued the legal battle on equal terms, if both sides had continued to make use of all their remedies at law, if the Patchogue Corporation had been able to press through higher courts its appeals as the Long Island Park Commission had been able to press its appeals, is impossible to determine. for both sides weren't equal. Lawsuits take money. The state's supply of this commodity is comparatively bottomless. The private citizens is not. And now W. Kingsland Macy was running out of money. Macy himself was not wealthy. Havemeyer was, but saying, "This should be considered a business affair," he told Macy he would have to pay all legal expenses over $25,000. At the time, Macy had thought that $25,000 would be ample, but as the commission's lawyers began to file appeal on top of appeal, he wrote Havemeyer that, to a layman, the ramifications of this litigation are almost beyond belief. And ramifications meant money. If Moses' lawyers were constantly filing new briefs, Macy's had to file briefs in reply. The briefs had to be printed in standard legal form, and they were running into thousands of pages. The printing bill for a single appeal ran to $3,652.63. The stenographic transcript for a single appeal cost $545. And finally, of course, there were the lawyers' fees. Lawyers like Tuttle and the experts required to handle appeals didn't come cheap. The first bill for services rendered was delivered to Macy on April 28, 1925. It was for $10,000. Even before the trial in Dunn's court began, the $25,000 mark had been reached. To Macy, the idealist, the case represented something that was more important than money. When Havemeyer wrote, "This is my limit," Macy replied that he would carry on alone. Appeals attorneys told him that if he was willing to press the fight vigorously, he would probably win, although the victory might not come until the case had been transferred out of the state courts and into the United States Supreme Court, which would focus on the basic constitutionality of the use by a state agency of one individual's money to seize the property of another. Macy authorized them to proceed, but Moses' attorneys continued to make motions and file briefs, and when Macy's appeal from Dunn's decision finally reached the appellate division in February 1928, his legal costs had mounted to $43,192.61. A burden beyond his financial resources. By April 1928, his attorneys were dunning him for payment of an $1,100 bill. Although the case would eventually be brought before the Court of Appeals, which upheld Dunn's decision, and an attempt was made to bring it to the United States Supreme Court, Justice Louis Brandeis brought the legal fight to an end on January 21, 1929, 4 years after the Biltmore hearing, by refusing to issue a writ of certiorari, which would have enabled the court to hear the case, it was obviously not pressed vigorously in these last stages, as though the case were really over already. And in fact, it was. Moses had never stopped developing the Taylor estate, as if its acquisition were a fait accompli. By the spring of 1927, he had laid concrete for access roads and parking fields, set out scores of stone fireplaces and picnic tables, erected wooden bathhouses with showers and lockers, and finished renovating the mansion and outbuildings at a total cost of hundreds of thousands of dollars. During the summer of 1927, it had hundreds of thousands of visitors. By the time the higher courts came to rule on the question of whether the Taylor estate was a park, it was a park. What was a judge to do? Tell the state to tear up the roads and tear down the buildings, to destroy what hundreds of thousands of dollars of the public's money had been spent to build? Tell the people who had visited the Taylor estate that they could visit it no more? In theory, of course, judges should not be influenced by such considerations, but judges are human, and their susceptibility to such considerations was undoubtedly increased by Moses' willingness to attack publicly those of them who ruled against him, as he had done to the local judge, thereby letting the public know exactly who it was who was closing the park to them. The final hearing before the State Court of Appeals was the 25th separate appellate proceeding in the Taylor Estate case. The case was, the Herald Tribune said, a landmark in eminent domain. It was also a landmark in the lifescapes of two men. W. Kingsland Macy, who had possessed before it a vague desire to enter politics, had been precipitated by it into the political arena, and had found he enjoyed fighting there. And Macy had learned in his first bout many tricks. After fighting Robert Moses, he was to say, fighting anyone else was easy. Becoming active in 1927 in the Suffolk County Republican organization, within a year he threw out its leader and seized his place. When the Depression loosened for a moment the Barons' stronghold on the state's GOP organization, Macy tore it from their grasp and, by 1932, was Republican state chairman. Although the GOP's old guard later reformed and ousted him from the chairmanship, he was to rule Suffolk County unchallenged for more than 30 years. When there came a time when it would be useful to him to be in the state Senate, he sent himself to the state Senate. When he wanted to go to Congress, he sent himself to Congress. Macy's views were liberal, and he introduced progressive governmental innovations in Suffolk County. But to achieve his aims, he ruled the county as an old-time political satrapy. Ruthless and cunning, he seemed to know every trick of bending men to his will, and he bent them so successfully that Kingsland Macy was called the Little King of Suffolk County. And when, after Macy had fought his way to power, Robert Moses, needing his help, made overtures of friendship, Macy accepted them. Although the strength of their personalities often made them clash, the two one-time amateurs in politics were for more than 30 years the closest of political allies. Allies so close, in fact, that when, in 1962, cancer-ravaged King Macy knew he was about to die, Moses was the only person outside his immediate family whom he wanted to see. Robert Moses had also learned from the Taylor estate fight, his first use of power, lessons that would govern his behavior for the rest of his life. One, hammered home in his consciousness by the results of his accommodation with G. Wilbur Doughty, was that the simplest method of accomplishing his aims was to use the power he possessed in all its manifestations, even those that as recently as a year previously he had shrunk from using. So thoroughly did he embrace this lesson, and the creature of the machine that was its embodiment, that when in 1927 a vacancy occurred on the Long Island Park Commission, he had Smith appoint McWinney to it. The simplicity, combined with the feeling of accomplishment, might well have made Moses ask himself if it really made any difference whether he worked with Tom McWinney. What difference did it make if the state purchased the right-of-way for the Meadowbrook Causeway from a bunch of farmers or from a bunch of Republican insiders? What difference did it make if he gave a road-building contract to Uncle Andy Weston? What difference did it make to the public, and what difference did it make to him? What did he care if Doughty's friends made money from his dreams? If they did, he had learned, the dream would become reality. If they did not, he had learned, it wouldn't. And the dream was the important thing. The dream was what mattered. This lesson Robert Moses translated into phrases that began to appear in his letters, and, according to associates, his conversation after the Taylor estate fight. The important thing is to get things done. You can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. If the end doesn't justify the means, what does? Another lesson Moses learned was that, in the eyes of the public, the end, if not justifying the means, at least made them unimportant. Al Smith had succeeded in blurring in the public's mind the legal technicalities of the fight by focusing the public's mind on the end of the fight, parks. The value of parks as an issue was another lesson. As long as you were fighting for parks, you could hardly help being a hero. When the Taylor fight started, he himself had been all but unknown. During the fight, he had been portrayed in 100 front-page stories and 100 editorials as a hero, as a man acting in the interest of the people at large and of all future generations. This lesson Robert Moses would often recite to associates. He would put it this way: as long as you're fighting for parks, you can be sure of having public opinion on your side. And as long as you have public opinion on your side, you're safe. As long as you're on the side of Parks, you're on the side of the Angels. You can't lose. There were other lessons, too. Whatever the motivation that had impelled him to take the risk of starting to transform the Taylor estate into a park while the courts had still seemed likely to rule that it was not a park, a fearless determination to do what he knew was right, regardless of the consequences, a blind faith in Smith's ability to rescue him from consequences, a desperation to see at last the beginning of the realization of at least one of his dreams, or perhaps an insight, the insight of a political genius, that physical development would help rather than hurt his cause, the risk had been magnificently justified. And he had understood the significance of that justification. Once you did something physically, it was very hard for even a judge to undo it. If judges, who had to submit themselves to the decision of the electorate only infrequently, were thus hogtied by the physical beginning of a project, how much more so would be public officials who had to stand for re-election year by year? If he had needed a gift from August Hexter to make victory certain, what did that prove? Only that once you physically began a project, there would always be some way found of obtaining the money to complete it. Once you sink that first stake, he would often say, they'll never make you pull it up. These lessons had other implications. If ends justified means, and if the important thing in building a project was to get it started, then any means that got it started were justified. Furnishing misleading information about it was justified. So was underestimating its costs. Misleading and underestimating, in fact, might be the only way to get a project started. Since his projects were unprecedentedly vast, one of the biggest difficulties in getting them started was the fear of public officials, not only upstate conservatives, but liberal public officials as well, concerned with the overall functioning of the state, that the state couldn't afford the projects, that the projects, beneficial though they might be, would drain off a share of the state's wealth incommensurate with their benefits. But what if you didn't tell the officials how much the projects would cost? What if you let the legislators know about only a fraction of what you knew would be the project's ultimate expense? Once they had authorized that small initial expenditure and you had spent it, they would not be able to avoid giving you the rest when you asked for it. How could they? If they refused to give you the rest of the money, what they had given you would be wasted, and that would make them look bad in the eyes of the public. And if they said you had misled them, well, they were not supposed to be misled. If they had been misled, that would mean that they hadn't investigated the projects thoroughly, and had therefore been derelict in their own duty. The possibilities for a polite but effective form of political blackmail were endless. Once a legislature gave you money to start a project, it would be virtually forced to give you the money to finish it. The stakes you drove should be thin-pointed, wedge-shaped, in fact, on the end. Once you got the end of the wedge for a project into the public treasury, it would be easy to hammer in the rest. Another lesson Moses learned from his first use of power was the latitude given him by its possession. In the Taylor estate fight, Moses had broken the law. On this point, there had been no judicial disagreement. No court had ruled that his first appropriation of the estate was legal. Every court that had ruled on it had ruled it illegal. But what had happened to him as a result? He had been fined 6 cents. 2 cents, actually, if he wanted to insist that the other two Long Island Park commissioners pay their share of the fine. Part of the reason was the Hexter gift, of course. But a more basic one was that power, specifically the power that came with the money he could dispose of as a state official, insulated him from the law's retribution. He had been able to employ lawyers numerous enough and clever enough to utilize the technicalities of the law to frustrate the intent of the law, to throw enough sand into the machinery of justice to slow its gears sufficiently so that they could not mesh and produce the conclusion which its spirit demanded. Even an opponent as determined as W. Kingsland Macy, and as well equipped with money as Macy was, had had to abandon his search for ultimate justice. Justice delayed, the Taylor Estate case proved, was truly justice denied. And Moses must have realized, for he demonstrated the realization in subsequent actions, as long as he had public power, as long as he was representing the state, he would have the means of employing as many lawyers as he needed, of delaying and thereby denying justice to his opponents, of shielding himself from its punishments. If there was one law for the poor, who have neither money nor influence, and another law for the rich, who have both, there is still a third law for the public official with real power, who has more of both. After the Taylor Estate fight, Robert Moses must have known, he proved it by his actions, that he could, with far more impunity than any private citizen, defy the law. He gloried in the knowledge. He boasted and bragged about it. For the rest of his life, when a friend, an enemy, or one of his own lawyers would protest that something he was doing or was proposing to do was illegal, Moses would throw back his head and say, with a broad grin, a touch of exaggeration, and much more than a touch of bravado, "Nothing I have ever done has been tinged with legality." There was one more lesson. It was one he had started learning years before, and now it had finally sunk in. Would dreams, dreams of real size and significance and scope, the accomplishment his mother had taught him was so important, ever be realized by the methods of the men in whose ranks he had once marched, the reformers and idealists? He asked the question of himself, and he answered it himself. No. The method he had adopted to turn his Long Island dream into reality was the way to accomplish something. It was the way to get things done. It was, he concluded, the only way. $1 million was the amount available to Long Island out of the $15 million. He had told the legislature that $1 million would be the cost of the Long Island program. He knew that actually the million would pay for only a fraction, a small fraction, of the program. But he had learned how to get things done. With the million, he drove a lot of stakes. Instead of spending the million to complete a few parks, he spent it to acquire the land for many, for Montauk Point State Park and Hither Hill State Park and Wildwood State Park and Sunken Meadow State Park and Belmont Lake State Park and Hempstead Lake State Park and Valley Stream State Park, and to at least begin development on all of them, as well as the Fire Island State Park and Jones Beach State Park he had previously acquired. By the end of 1926, the beaches of Long Island, once reserved for the rich, were dotted with wooden bathhouses open to all. Families who weren't interested in ocean swimming had to travel along Merrick Road only 2 miles beyond the city line before they came to the Valley Stream Park's wooded 97 acres and calm blue lake, and in the woods, hiking trails, picnic tables, and fireplaces, and on the lake, floats, diving boards, sliding ponds, and rowboats were awaiting their use. By the end of 1926, moreover, the road was begun that would free city drivers from the tyranny of Merrick Road. By the time surveying of the route for the Southern State Parkway was completed, it was August. DPW engineers protested that it was too close to the cold, damp Long Island winter to begin construction, but there was plenty of time to drive stakes. To show the public quickly how beautiful his parkways would be, he decided that the first segment would be the 2.78-mile loop around the huge reservoir in Hempstead Lake State Park, the prettiest portion of the whole route. On August 28, 1926, with only a handful of engineers and an uninterested construction gang as an audience, Robert Moses dug a spade into the soil near the reservoir and jerked it out. The earth that came up with it was the first ever turned for a Robert Moses road. His talk with Francis Perkins about the highway below Riverside Drive had taken place in 1914, a full 12 years before. He had been planning roads ever since. As he stood there holding the shovel, a foreman gave a signal, and laborers began to shovel dirt into the small, spoke-wheeled dump trucks that in the 1920s served as earth-moving machines. Robert Moses stepped back, and watched the work begin. Hutchinson and Hewitt were amazed and angry over Moses' progress in 1926. Counting the DPW and Conservation Department funds he had used, he had already spent on Long Island parks far more than the $1 million that was supposed to pay for the whole Long Island Park and Parkway system, and now he submitted park improvement requests that totaled $1 million more. And who knew what innocent-appearing items in 1927 DPW and Conservation Department budget requests concealed additional funds Smith was planning to make available to Moses. A wholly disproportionate share of the state budget was being spent on Long Island. In a private confrontation with Smith and Moses, they said that Moses' plans were too grandiose. Their cost was beyond the ability of the state to pay, they said, and parks were simply not needed on the scale he proposed. The conflict came to a head over Jones Beach. In 1926, public paving beaches in America fell into one of two classifications: ill-equipped huddles of shabby, unpainted wooden bathhouses that contained nothing but toilets, showers, and lockers, or boardwalk beaches, such as Coney Island and Atlantic City, which had surrendered the beauty of their seascapes to roller coasters, weight-guessing games, blaring funhouses, bawling barkers, and other carnival concessions. But Robert Moses wasn't thinking of unpainted wood or carnivals. One day, he invited to Jones Beach Gilmore Clark, landscape architect of the Bronx River Parkway, Harvey W. Corbett, the architect responsible for the design of some of the Long Island Barons' most beautiful manor houses, several other famous architects, landscape architects, and engineers, and a handful of young commission staffers with whose work he had been impressed. As the little group of men stood on the vast, empty expanse of sand, Moses began pointing. "One bathhouse would be over there," he said, "and the other over there. But then they would be almost a mile apart," the men with him pointed out. "Yes," he said, "and they should understand at once that he wasn't talking about ordinary bathhouses. These were going to contain 10,000 lockers apiece. In addition to bathrooms and shower rooms, they were going to contain wading pools, diving pools, and swimming pools, and the swimming pools were going to be large enough to accommodate hundreds of bathers at a time. There were going to be canopied terraces above the pools, so people could sit in the shade and watch the swimmers. And there were going to be other terraces on which people could dine at tables set beneath gaily colored umbrellas. The bathhouses were going to contain solaria. They were going to contain restaurants in every price range. Although they were at a bathing beach, they were going to be constructed not of wood, but of stone and brick. And the stone and brick were going to be of the finest quality. They were going to be surrounded by landscaped lawns, hedges, and flower beds. And he wanted the bathhouses designed with as much care as the finest public buildings in America. With this difference: most public buildings in America were too heavy and stodgy, designed only to impress and awe. The bathhouses would have to be quite large, of course, but they were buildings for people to have a good time in. The architecture must encourage people to have fun. It must be airy and light, gay and pleasant. There must be 1,000 little touches to make people feel happy and relaxed. And he didn't want the bathhouses to spoil the panorama. Let them be designed to complement it, not dominate it. The panorama was long, low lines of sand and dunes, and the sweep of the ocean. Let the lines of the bathhouses be long, low, and sweeping, he said, horizontal rather than vertical. One other thing, he said. The bathhouses were going to have at least one innovation never included in any public or private building in America: diaper-changing rooms. He had designed them himself, he said. They would be divided into cubicles, and each cubicle would contain only a diaper disposal basket, a wash basin, a mirror, and a shelf for a mother to lay her baby on. And the shelf shouldn't be table height, he said. He had watched mothers changing diapers, and higher shelves would make it easier. Francis Perkins would have smiled. Yanking an envelope from his pocket, Moses began to sketch on its back two X's to represent the bathhouses, lines to show how they would be connected on the beach side by a wide boardwalk, on the bay side by an ocean parkway. Midway between the two X's, where the causeway from the mainland would join the parkway, he drew a large circle between two squares. The causeway would end in a circle, he said. People who didn't want to use the bathhouses could drive around it and into the squares, parking lots, each large enough to hold 10,000 cars, and then walk with their families to the beach through underpasses under the parkway, or they could drive around the circle, stop on the beach side, drop their families off first, and then park in the lots and walk back to the beach to join them. Or, if they didn't want to go to the beach at all, they could simply keep driving on the parkway, east or west. The families that got out at the circle would walk to the beach along a broad mall that ended at the boardwalk, and along the boardwalk would be open-air cafes serving inexpensive meals and a restaurant with cuisine, atmosphere, and service equal to the finest in America. And stretching off to either side would be outdoor games, pitch and putt golf, table and paddle tennis, shuffleboard, roller skating rinks, baseball fields set in little stadia. For the evenings, there would be bandstands and dancing under the stars. He sketched in restaurants, parking lots, playing fields, and bandstands until there was no more room on the envelope. One of the famous architects standing around Moses said, "Are you crazy?" The others knew what the architect meant. As one was later to put it, "It was the scale of the thing. Nothing on a scale like this had ever been done in public recreation in America. Here we were on an absolutely deserted sandbar. There was no way even to get there but by boat, and here was this guy drawing X's on the back of an envelope and talking about bathhouses like palaces and parking lots that held 10,000 cars. Why, I don't think there was a parking lot for 10,000 cars anywhere in America. And landscaping? Landscaping on a sandbar? We weren't even sure anything would grow on a sandbar. We thought he was nuts." The men gathered around Moses included some of the biggest names in American architecture, but they didn't think big enough for him. When they began drawing up tentative plans, the plans naturally included a water tower. Fresh water had to be provided in great quantities in any large park, of course. But their water towers were conventional water towers, aluminum storage tanks set on four spindly uprights. They were exactly like the ones that, in other parks, were invariably the unsightliest feature of the landscape. Moses determined to turn the potentially ugliest part of the park he had planned into its most beautiful. He already knew that he wanted a focal point for the beach, a beautiful centerpiece big enough to be seen from miles away that would be a symbol of Jones Beach, something that visitors could identify with. He was, after all, the son of a woman who had ordered the huge Camp Madison banner, and it might as well be the water tower. But he had a hard time getting the architects to think in his terms. "I was very anxious to have this water tower mean something architecturally," he recalls. "I got the top people out there, and I asked them about it. The first suggestion came from our chief engineer, and I said, 'That's the goddamnedest, stupidest thing I've ever heard of.' And then someone suggested a lighthouse, and I said, 'No, goddammit, we're not going to have any lighthouse. We already had a lighthouse, for God's sake.'" He was referring to the Fire Island Lighthouse, which was visible from the eastern end of Jones Beach. On the next trip to the beach, Harvey Corbett suggested that the water tower be designed as an Italian campanile, or church bell tower. There were many different types, Corbett said, and started to reel them off. As he was reeling, he mentioned the one in Venice. Venice. "I like the one in Venice best," Moses said. According to one of the men there, he pulled out another one of his envelopes and sketched the campanile in Venice right there, and that's how the water tower was done. And that's the way most everything was done. He had the architects and the engineers there, but he was the architect and the engineer of Jones Beach. He's more responsible for the design of Jones Beach than any architect or engineer, or all of us put together. Finding the bathhouse designs submitted by the famous architects unimaginative, Moses selected those of an unknown young commission staffer, Herbert Magoon. Magoon had designed two vast pleasure palaces to sit upon the sand. One was a long, low, sweeping expanse of brick and stone and green-tinted glass. Its central portion, a terrace raised just 5 feet above the beach. Behind the terrace, wide expanses of green-tinted glass separated by thin vertical stone columns that held another set-back terrace surmounted by canopies. And behind that terrace, a wall topped with flags was set off from two wings of glass and brickwork by two simple, square, flat-topped medieval turrets. It was simple, almost austere from a distance, but Magoon's detailed drawings showed Moses that the turrets and walls had been cunningly worked with a thousand little devices of stone and brick. The other bathhouse was, if also of stone and brick, much gayer. Middle Eastern, in fact, almost Moorish. If the first bathhouse, despite its lack of height, resembled a medieval castle like those from which knights rode forth to join the Crusades, the second looked like one of the castles the knights saw when they reached the Holy Land. Each of its two towers, which seemed, at 60 feet, very tall against the dunes, was topped, in fact, with a green turret that swirled upward into a little spear point, as did the helmets of the Sultan's warriors the knights might have had to fight. Moses was ecstatic over the designs. He loved them, he said. But, the morning after he first saw them, he called in Magoon with endless lists of small changes he wanted to make. Moses decided himself how he wanted the bathhouses faced. He was determined that the stone and brick of the facades would blend in perfectly with the beach on which they stood. One of the samples brought to him was obviously the perfect type of stone. Ohio sandstone was gray with just enough tinges of tan and blue to catch the colors of sand and sea. Selecting the brick was harder. Nothing seemed exactly right. Then, one day, passing the Barbizon Hotel on East 63rd Street, he noticed that it was faced with a random pattern of beige, brown, and brownish-red that would catch the color of the sand and complement it. He decided that, to give the Jones Beach development unity, every structure of any size built there would be faced with Ohio sandstone and Barbizon brick. The architects hastened to explain to him that Ohio sandstone and Barbizon brick were simply not used on public buildings. They were among the most expensive of all facing materials. Why, by using them on structures as large and elaborate as those he had in mind, each bathhouse would cost alone what Moses had originally said would be the cost of the entire Long Island Park system, $1 million. Ohio sandstone and Barbizon brick, it was going to be, Moses replied. Hutchinson and Hewitt were guys from the backwoods, recalls one who knew them. When you said water tower to them, that meant a tank on four skinny poles. A bathhouse was a little wooden thing you put up for 50 or 100 bucks so the boys couldn't watch the girls undressing. And here Moses comes along and tells them he wants to spend $1 million on one. They flatly refused to give him anything like it. Only after Smith had pleaded with them for hours did they consent to appropriate a total of $150,000. For the water tower and both bathhouses. Moses' architects expected him to tell them to scale down their plans.
You just go right on the way you were doing, Moses told them. You forget all about what the appropriation is. I'm never going to put up just a tank on poles.
He had already told Smith his plan.
I told him, we'll put all the money into the foundation for one bathhouse. And then, when it gives out, we'll just go back and tell them they'll have to give us more, or leave the foundation just sitting there with no building on top of it. The governor thought it was kind of a good joke.
The foundation laid, Moses invited Hewitt and Hutchinson down to see what he had done. To make matters stickier, blowing sand had completely buried the foundation the night before they arrived, and there was not a trace of it visible.
All that existed, as far as the two legislators could see, was a godforsaken sandbar that could be of no possible use to anyone, and the knowledge that, somewhere on it, on their authorization, had been spent $150,000 of the taxpayers' money. They raged. They demanded that Smith fire Moses. In Moses' words, they went to the governor and said, "Get rid of that son of a bitch, and we'll go along with something reasonable." But, in Moses' words, "the governor never backed away from me." So, Hutchinson and Hewitt said they would see that Moses was impeached, and they guaranteed the governor that every appropriation for every park in the state would be cut off until this mess was cleaned up. But Moses had applied his lessons well. When his antagonists began to think about the situation, they realized they were trapped. What exactly, for all their power, could they do? Charge that he had misled them, thereby admitting that they hadn't investigated the project thoroughly enough in advance? Deny him further funds, thereby ensuring that the $150,000 already spent would be utterly wasted? And wasn't the overriding issue the same one, parks versus no parks, with which Smith had destroyed them in 1925? Did they want to make him a hero again? There was, really, very little they could do. Trying to salvage some revenge, they refused, in making the 1927 budget appropriations, to give Moses any money at all for the second bathhouse, for which the foundation had not been laid, and they saw to it that the additional funds they gave him for other Long Island Park projects were far less than he wanted even to complete the buildings already begun. But such satisfactions were small ones. They knew that the difference needed to complete the projects to Moses' specifications could easily be made up by Smith out of the appropriations to other state departments. Chapter 13. Driving. Despite its outcome, the battle over the bathhouses filled Moses with a sense less of triumph than of dread, of a need for haste so frantic that it was almost desperation. Time, he was afraid, was running out on his dream, and it was running out fast. The battle had shown him how little chance he would have of completing his dream without the unflinching support of Alfred E. Smith in the governor's chair. He knew that he could never hope to receive anything near the full amount he still needed from the legislature, and the public itself might well waver in its support for his parks if it knew their full cost. He had Smith as governor now, but he wasn't going to have him for long. Al Smith, he knew, was going to be a candidate for president in 1928, and that meant that he could not, under state law, be a candidate for governor. On January 1, 1929, there was going to be a new governor. He probably would be a Republican. Even if he were a Democrat, he would not be Al Smith. January 1, 1929 was less than 2 years away, and 2 years was far too short a time for completion of a dream that encompassed three long roads and a score of huge parks. His only hope, he knew, was to complete enough of the roads and parks before Smith left office so that the public could see how great they were going to be and would demand that they all be completed. So Moses drove himself, and he drove his men. Turning the upstairs bedrooms of August Belmont's mansion into offices, Moses filled the offices with engineers and architects. He himself worked downstairs. Belmont had had this tremendous dining room, and there was this huge table there, and Moses made it his conference table, recalls William J. Junkerman, an attorney hired to assist Commission Counsel Raymond McNulty. The conferences would start at 9 o'clock in the morning, and sometimes you couldn't leave until after midnight. And you just worked like hell all day long. Supper was a matter of dashing out and getting a bite to eat as quick as you could. Insisting that the engineers in charge of a project prepare a schedule showing the date on which each of its phases would be completed, Moses would move up the deadlines, by days, by weeks, sometimes by months, until the engineers felt it was absolutely impossible to meet them, and then he insisted that they be met. "The time was never long enough," Gilmore Clark says, "but that was all the time you were going to get, and he let you know it." James J. Flynn, captain of the state police troop assigned to the commission, recalls, "If he wanted a job done, he wanted it done, period. And he wouldn't take any alibis if it wasn't done."